welcome to the Washington AI Network podcast. I'm Tammy Haddad, host and founder of the Washington AI Network, where we highlight the conversations of DC insiders and influencers who are challenging, debating, and just trying to figure out the rules of the road for artificial intelligence. From national security to digital privacy, education, healthcare, the future of jobs, and building confidence and trust in AI systems. Come with us and explore the most pressing issues and the biggest players in AI. My voice sounds familiar. You may have heard my Cone of Silence podcast or Bloomberg's Masters in Politics or maybe The Washington Insider. Welcome to the first episode and the first meeting of the Washington AI Network. We gathered at the House at 1229 and kicked off the discussion on the latest AI developments. We began with two leading AI policy voices, Victoria Espinel, a key member of the National Artificial Intelligence Advisory Committee, advising the president and working with countries. She's also the president and CEO of BSA, the Software Alliance. And Kelly Wicker, the director of the Science and Technology Innovation Program at the Wilson Center, providing analysis, advising Congress, and translating how AI technologies will impact the world. This is our first conversation for the Washington AI Network, and we had had a media put it together because there's nothing more important than AI. Now it's bigger than the internet, it's bigger than everything. It's going to change how we live, how we love, how we govern, everything about our lives. So we thought, well, let's just create a place where people can come and talk about things and really what they're doing. In the future, we'll focus on elections and specific kinds of things. And I'm really thrilled to have these two folks here to get things started for us. First of all, Kelly Wicker, she's at the Wilson Center. She's Director of Science, Technology, Innovation Program. She's been working with Congress. She's been working actually with all of us to educate people on AI. Everyone, welcome Kelly. And then Victoria Espinel, you guys know her. She's the president and CEO of BSA. And through this whole experience, she's always the person I turn to on the internet, the National Artificial Intelligence Advisory Committee, which also, we're going to talk to Miriam about that too. She's the chairman and a member of the club. But we got to start these conversations. We've got to make sure that we're doing it the right way. Everyone here has something to say. And by the way, we're going to want you to say it. But I want to begin with you guys. And Victoria, I'm going to start with you and really talk about this committee because you've been working on this with people around the world for the past year. So why don't you get us started?
So we are about 14 months. We just started year two. We issued a report with recommendations for the Biden administration in May. So I would encourage anyone who hasn't read it to read it. There are lots of different recommendations. I won't attempt to go through them all, but I will mention one in particular because it's relevant to the International Cooperation Working Group that I chair, which is to take the great work that our Department of Commerce has done through something called the NIST framework. But essentially, it's a set of practices that companies can put in place to try to mitigate risk in artificial intelligence and then internationalize that or have as much cooperation with other governments as they can. I can also tell you that just yesterday, the international working group that I chair, within the NIAC committee as a whole, finalized a recommendation to governments that as you are putting together global summits and global gatherings, that you think about reaching out to emerging economies and make part of that conversation. There are lots of great conversations happening now around the world in the G7 and the OECD between the United States and the European Commission, but having the voice of emerging economies in those conversations, I think, is something that the NIAC committee as a whole thinks is very important.
How's that going so far, though?
I think in terms of pulling those summits together, and there's a couple of people in the room that could probably tell us a little bit more about pulling summits together. I think there's a real appetite for that. Mm-hmm. So,
great. Thanks for getting us started. Kelly, so you've been working with Congress, educating Congress, bringing all the important players together, and also the rest of us, and just really trying to put the right things in front of the right people. And I know you had this pilot program at Howard University. Maybe start there because some of us were on an off-the-record call today, and there was a lot of red teaming going on there, which is something I never heard of. They don't have that in politics. Maybe they should. But why don't you talk about that pilot? I think that sort of takes people into what you've been doing and how you're really working through what Victoria's talking about.
Yeah, so the Wilson Center is really thrilled to be a part of a coalition of a lot of partners that are putting on the largest and probably the first public generative AI red teaming event. For those of you who are not techies, Red teaming is when essentially you've built a tech product, and before you would release it to the public, you want to make sure that it's safe and secure. So you hire people to attack it, to use it as if they were trying to get it to be used for malicious purposes. And when those people discover that they forced it to do something malicious, they report it to you, you fix it before it goes public. This is a really long-standing practice in cybersecurity. Red teaming is very established. Red team versus blue team is also a thing that we do. But in AI, it's kind of a new concept, partially because when you report a vulnerability that you found, with AI, it's very difficult to do anything about that. It's more of like a now you know, so live around it kind of concept. So early on in the field, there wasn't a lot of talk about public red teaming especially. It was kind of just like a, you know, do it for your own good internally. We are doing this large pilot, this large exercise at DEF CON next month. And the goal here is to talk about the importance of not just red teaming, not just red teaming in public, but also diverse red teaming. We are contending that if the people who test the systems are the same kind of person as the people who made them, they are not going to find any mistakes that the original team wasn't going to find already. But, and that's why you see things released. ChatGPT exploded on the scene and immediately started blundering everywhere, not because of anyone's fault, but just because these systems are very complex and it's hard to find the mistakes, especially when the people who test it are the same people who made it. What we've seen, so yesterday we did a pilot of this red teaming exercise at Howard. So at DEF CON, we're talking about having 3,500 people red team. We have all of the 8 major companies on board contributing their models, which is really exciting. Yesterday, we had 25 students, a little smaller, red teaming a open source model, so much less powerful, but just kind of testing the concept. Did we actually see new stuff happen when you had non-traditional people red teaming it? The answer was yes. So we had about 25 students who in 1 hour generated 1,000 attacks on the systems. And within those, there was some stuff we've never seen people be able to make a model do. The one that won was they managed to get it to tell them a credit card number. Now, this could have been a hallucination, but obviously if this is a system that actually had access to credit card numbers, that would be a big problem. And so it kind of showcased that the core concept that we arrived with, this concept that diversity of opinion, of background, of person matters, hasn't really been tested. So we weren't sure, does it actually matter? And we kind of feel like, okay, we were right. We're onto something. Why this is all important is because Congress has been talking about red teaming increasingly when we talk about AI security. Should we be mandating red teaming? Should we be mandating public red teaming that helps the public have a better understanding of what's happening? And the White House is about to say, yes, we should mandate both public and private red teaming, and it should be a big part of how we develop systems. And so we're really excited. The White House OSTP is a partner on our event at DEF CON, so we're looking forward to them being able to package what we learn and keep moving with it. And we're not gonna stop at DEF CON. After we finish that, we're planning on continuing to work with community colleges and historically Black universities to teach people how to red team so that they can continue to work. We're just really stinking excited about it. Wow,
that's fantastic. Okay, but what everyone wants to know is what is Congress going to do for the first time? You've got political parties, right? Both parties. You've got the White House saying we're in this, we're going to regulate. You've got Congress. So Victoria, what's going to happen? Or what do you think the priorities are?
Yeah, so I think, you know, in the U.S., you have Congress, you have the administration, and you have the states. And I think regulation is going to happen in one of those areas. But in terms of what I think should happen, and it's not just the U.S., there are governments around the world that are looking at this. I would say 3 things. One is, I think focusing on the biggest addressable risks and the place where we can have the most beneficial impact is what government should do. There's so many different issues, but there are some, like bias and discrimination, which is one that's very important to me personally, that I think can be addressed. And so I think government's focusing on what the biggest risks are that can be addressed. And then I would really encourage governments to also use their, you know, considerable powers to encourage affirmative use of artificial intelligence to try to address societal challenges. So I think that is
you mean you
one.
Need a statement that says that?
Because I think that is there's a lot of conversation, as there should be, about the
right
risks and what they are to address them. But I think there also needs to be, and I've been saying this for years, there needs to be at least an equal conversation about, are there positive uses to which AI could affirmably be put, and have government is only one of the voices, but have that government voice in promotion of that. The second thing I would say is, you know, think about the long haul, make it work for the long haul. this technology changes very quickly, like many technologies. We've seen that even in the last few months. So having something that's going to still be applicable 2 or 3, 5, 10 years from now, I think is important. And then the last thing that I would say is I feel very strongly about this. I think there's so much government interest right now because of ChatGPT and because of sort of the impact that that's had. And I think that creates an opportunity that will not last that long for governments to come together and cooperate. And so I would say I think we have maybe 6 to 12 months, but I think there is, and I think this based on conversations I'm having with governments around the world, I think there is a real sincere desire for a number of governments to come together on a harmonized approach, maybe not identical, but that won't last forever. So I think it's now. So I would encourage any government that I talk to seize that opportunity and move as quickly as possible.
Well, I have to turn, by the way, first, but I'm going to follow up on that to Miriam Vogel, who, if you guys have not met her, has been running Equal AI, done such a remarkable job. Do you mind standing up and telling people what you're doing? Because you're on the front lines of this and have made so much progress, but so much to do.
Certainly.
So, Miriam. And I work so hard, please.
So, Equal AI, I'll tell you briefly, and myself in the process. We've been around almost 5 years. We were created with the express purpose of reducing bias and harms in responsible in artificial intelligence. Because I'm an optimist and don't like to just focus on the negatives, we also spend a lot of our time focusing on the upside, and that's responsible AI governance. And luckily, that's gone from a topic that people didn't know about 5 years ago to something people are really interested in. In this very room, we had one of our first AI summits for our batch participants, and we run a batch program for senior executives to learn what is responsible AI governance. And it's a unique bubble of companies and executives who care about this, that are already invested, and they just want to know, until we get this legislation, until we get international consolidation on best practices, we align with AI leaders together. Victoria is a key part of that. She's one of the judges in that summit,
yeah.
And her staff helps to teach it. And so one of our main focuses is, first of all, helping companies understand you're now an AI company because you're using AI in pivotal ways. So you thought you did products and services, wake up, now you're an AI company, and then we'll help you figure out what to do from there. Our second main constituency is policymakers, which, thanks to the work of the Wilson Center, is now a lot easier than it was a few years ago. There's a lot more savvy. I think many of you know from personal experience, there's a lot of interest, there's a lot of, I'm optimistic. I think we had a lunch earlier this week with this bipartisan huge coalition, and they are focused on what is tangible, what not just the sexy topics, but what can we do today, as well as a bigger picture. So between that and what we're seeing across the executive branch, we've seen almost all the alphabet soup of federal agencies speak on this and talk about how they're going to be mindful of how they're using it internally, as well as the regulatory front. So that's our second constituency, is there is lawyers. My bias as a lawyer is we need to be doing more to help our clients and our organizations reduce bias with frameworks and other ways that we mitigate risks and biases. That's us. We have a podcast. You can often hear Victoria co-host this. It's called In AI We Trust? ? We try to bring on leaders in responsible AI governance. I also have the privilege of serving with Victoria on the NIAC. We're lucky to be hearing from.
To be very clear, right, Miriam is the chair.
She's the chair of the whole thing. I am the chair. So what it is, there's 25 of us across industry who were appointed by the president to advise the president and the White House on AI policy. We are arranged into working groups to get the work done, because as many of you have worked with 25 experts, you know that is scheduling alone can stop the cracks. So we are very smart and have Victoria lead as many of our working groups as possible. No joke, people have asked us to switch their working groups so they could be on Victoria's and get stuff done. So I'm very glad listening to you tonight.
Thank you, Marian. Thanks for everything. So OpenAI today talked about government licenses for these AI systems. What do you guys think about that?
I think it's potentially interesting to see what that would look like. But I will also say, I think there are a lot of different ways that I think you can put guardrails or regulation or whatever word you want to use in artificial intelligence. And I think it makes sense to do that. I think licensing schemes aren't necessarily the most efficient way to do that. So that, I think that was something that would need to be worked through.
Yeah, I'm very similar opinion actually, but I think the concept of licensing the foundation models, the most powerful ones like GPT-4, that makes sense to me in that, you know, there's concerns that through legislation we're going to create a moat where only the established players can actually conform to this regulation, and we're going to keep all the smaller players out. I think given that the future of AI is most likely going to be largely driven by hyper-specialized small models that are tuned to a very specific task, creating a moat on the most powerful models is not necessarily an issue, because the amount of compute required, the amount of data required, and money required to create these models is such that there already was a moat. So in terms of licensing foundation models that are generally very flexible and adaptable and can be used for good or for bad in a very powerful way, that tends to make sense to me. It is, I would agree, not necessarily the most effective way to do it, but it is a way that government knows how it works. And I think right now when we're trying to prioritize things that are relatively quickly moving but still a smart decision, we want to use tracks that government already understands instead of creating an entirely new thing that we're trying to grapple with. So I think, yeah, generally it makes sense, I think.
So with a company's line, like what you're talking about, trying to figure all of this out, the companies are aligned in some way. I mean, literally, like, how do you get control of all of it? I mean, Congress always gets caught up in all the details, and rightly so, you know. But how do you think, because you're talking about today, people talk about it all the time, we've got the 6 months, we've got 12 months. How do you cut through all the noise and get really down to, here's three things we can do? I mean, is that going to be on you guys, or... is that going to be, the Schumer guys are here, right? Are they still here? And who's going to do that?
So I think, so I represent the enterprise-facing part of the software industry, and I think that makes it easier for me in some ways, because those are companies that have a business model that is largely aligned. And so when you say the industry, like, that becomes much harder when you have business models that are, you know, companies that have different ways of making money. I think certainly in the enterprise space, you know, I think the companies have been pretty forward-leaning on regulation, and we have a very detailed set of ideas about what regulation should look like, and we've kind of leaned into that early and often. But I think, you know, in terms of if I were a policymaker, like in terms of, you know, stepping back from that, it goes to what I was saying before. I think one of the things that I think what governments need to do is think about, okay, there are, what, 25, 100? There is such a long list of risks that you can come up with. So I think, like, filtering that by, like, all right, here are ones that are really consequential and ones that we actually think we can address, and we're going to focus on those. And to the extent there's going to be a regulatory focus, I think that is the universe that policymakers need to focus on. And I think once you... I think that's the big task at hand. I have my own views on, like, what that universe looks like, but I think that's what policymakers need to do, because trying to move in 100 different directions at once is going to make it, it's going to make it impossible to get anything done.
Right. And then the other piece of it is, Kelly, that people are afraid of the technology, the robots. I love the name of this act today that Senator Casey, No Robot Bosses Act. Someone in my office said, we don't have that hat at media. Someone else said, I wish we did. And then, well, we'll talk about workplace in a minute, but there's this fear of this technology, which you can't really define, even as we're talking about it. It's, you know, long, it's pieced, it's this, it's that. It's, how are you going to get, why are you going to get people to not be afraid, to embrace it, when you come up with this, these trust, areas of trust and safety, whatever you want to call it, whatever way you do it, how are you going to get people to trust and believe that, you know, this is all in the up and up?
I have a three-part answer. So, first part is, there are, to a certain degree, I don't ever want you to fully trust it. I want you to remain skeptical, especially as we start looking at potentially the enabling of a wave of disinformation. Of course, we always had Photoshop. We could always tamper with photos, but now the skill level required to do so is significantly reduced. So don't fully trust things. That's a smart approach. The second thing is, I think there's, like, an old poster that's been up in MIT's computer science department since, like, the 70s that says a computer should never make a decision. And while there are many tiny little decisions that we should and can and are in the process of automating with AI, a decision that has sweeping consequences, like pressing the nuclear bomb button or wholesale laying off 20% of your workforce. Those are decisions that should never be made by a computer. And so determining when to use AI. Let's not do what we did when apps came out and everything was an app suddenly and you had to download 1,700 apps and none of them worked. Let's not go to that. Let's think very critically about what should we automate? Where is AI actually tuned to do a good job and where should it be kept out of the loop? And then last thing I think is we bring things into the light. We bring more transparency. And I'm going to go back to my red teaming hobby horse. Part of one of the reasons we think public red teaming is really important is because understanding intimately the problems that these systems face and publicly dealing with it is part of building trust. You don't tell people they're perfect, it's fine, don't worry about it. You tell people these are flawed systems and you're a part of fixing them, and now you know how we're fixing them. And now you know where to report something that happens. And now you know what happens if something happens. Bringing transparency, there are some things we can never be transparent about. We're not going to share the training data sets that are building these models. That would be a huge industry secret. We're not going to show the model weights that make the model work. But we can tell you how it works, when it's being used, when are you talking to a chatbot, when is your health insurance using a machine learning model to make decisions about your care. You should know those things. Transparency is essential for building trust, and building trust is one of the reasons that Americans trust technology far more than you see in other countries. We tend to believe that someone has thought about this and someone has put a structure in place that can let us trust it. And that's what we're grappling with right now. Are we putting that structure in place?
Right. Thank you. That's great. Teresa, do you want to jump in here? You've been dealing with all this for a long time.
Yes. Hi, everybody. I'm Teresa Carlson. I'm at a supply chain and logistics company that I worked for 25 years in tech, Microsoft and Amazon. I was around when Amazon actually created their first AI tool. Cloud computing, nobody knew about in 2010. In 2010, when I started doing this at AWS, we had to go to Capitol Hill. And when I would talk about cloud, they would say, when I would say, I'm here with Amazon, and they would say, are you here to talk about books or taxes? And I would say, no, I don't know about cloud computing. And they would say, what's cloud computing? And people, it's kind of the same thing with AI. So one of my, we had a great discussion today in Victoria. They were going to do an amazing job. Love your comments. I like the red TV design. But what I would say is education, and more education. We've got to be realistic that this has to be early and often for everyone. Because you can start regulating on one, but you're not going to stop technology evolution. And just to give you one example of how quickly this moved, when I was at Microsoft, in the 10 years I was there, we would release one service every 3 years, and we thought that was innovation. When I got to AWS and you got to cloud, the first year I got there, we released 25 new services. In 10 years when I left there, we were releasing over 2,700 new services and features a year. It's gone way beyond that. So when you have AI involved, you're going to even go way beyond that. So you have to look at it from teaching, training, educating at every level. You have to look at what are the risks. I totally agree, they have risks. Government has to be involved early and often. They can't be behind the ball. They have to be in front of the ball, if that makes sense. Where is the puck going? And I respectfully say we are oftentimes trying to figure out where it's going. So it's just, we've got to be more thoughtful and bring in experts. I love that you're doing this, the committee chat. I mean, we were so far behind in cloud with government doing that, honestly. It took way too long. So I will say on the positive, people are paying attention. They are bringing experts. And my last comment was figuring out, you know, like when we went from horses to wheels and cars, we have to figure out again, what's the good things? And respectfully to the British, I'm married to a Brit, but in America, the innovation is off the charts, and I was always really proud of my work with the Brits. We did amazing things together. But in America, we need to determine, let's embrace their innovation and celebrate it and make sure that we are celebrating how we take these companies to the next level. And I loved your comment about let's not forget about the small men and women that create these companies. We have to take care of them. And mammoth companies will do all this heavy lifting. Let them go do it. And they create a model that allows the smaller companies to move much faster. And Tammy, thank you for doing this. I think it's such an important topic.
That's great. Thanks so much. Karen, I know you've worked with all these companies. You want to jump in here on the, you've had to deal with a lot of these legal issues for a long time. I mean, I don't know how you figured this out. That's a long contract coming.
I mean, the question that I had, that I asked last week at the event we're at, and Victoria and I worked on this together for a number of years, is, you know, we still aren't there on the privacy front with the government. So I'm curious, like, what's different about this? Like, how are we going to get there with regulating AI when we still don't have a federal privacy law all these many years after GDPR?
So I do think it goes back to this window. The Congress, the states, the administration, governments around the world, and I would say the UK has been really thoughtful on AI policy for 5 or 6 years. I think you're the first government that I know of to set up like an internal AI advisory structure 6 or 7 years ago when governments weren't thinking about it. I had the chance to meet with the gentleman. But I do think there's this moment right now where people are seized with it in a way that they where the privacy legislation never had that momentum behind it. And I think there's a real opportunity there. But I will go back to, like, I don't think it will last forever. I think 12 months from now, it will have dissipated. So I think this is really the moment to seize, to try to move together. And if we can move, like, if we can sort of move collectively, globally together, I agree, 193 countries together is not going to be feasible. But I think there's the number of countries that would be very excited to work together now.
If I can jump in just really quick. I totally agree that there's a window now that's closing. I'm not sure we're gonna hit it. you know, the AI is one of the few issues that's not partisan on the Hill. I don't know how long that will last, but I do know that even so, there's a lot of these questions that the EU, that the UK, that Canada are grappling with in terms of things like algorithmic justice, that we are just like, and Congress is not addressing those things. The questions of bias, the questions that really, I think, at the core are gonna affect people's lives, we're not touching that because that's when it's gonna start getting political. So if we can't touch the things that matter, if we can't actually create these guardrails that are gonna do anything, like my take, and this is me, not Wilson Center, is that rather than do what Congress does sometimes and create a new agency and then say, we did something, all right, move on. I would much rather see the empowerment of the existing regulatory agencies to just go ahead and exercise their jurisdiction on AI systems. And a lot of them are already taking steps to do so, but they need clarity from Congress to be able to actually act. That is something Congress can do because they're not going to be the ones holding the bag if it goes poorly. And it's a lot of people on the Hill are concerned. They don't want to get it wrong and then be the ones who got it wrong. So, you know, I think Congress, we heard this last week, that there's a lot of interest in legislating specific use cases, which is great. But I think we should empower regulatory agencies while we can still agree on doing something. I think the NIST framework is great. The blueprint for the Bill of Rights are all great. We're all talking about things in the right way. I just am not sure we can ever make that law. So,
right. But I would say, but regulation is going to happen. Like, it's the European Commission is going to move. I think the UK is going to come up with a policy approach. Like, it's going to happen. It's just, I think the question is, like, is the United States kind of an active participant in that conversation?
Yeah.
While it's happening, and I would argue that they should be, and not just the United States. I think there are a number of other countries that should be too. So it's going to happen. Just the question is, I think, whether or not, you know, how is the U.S. there kind of at the table early and often, to use a phrase that someone else used.
We have to talk about election security. And I don't know if anyone here too, if someone wants to jump in along the way, please do. Okay. What are you going to do about the deep fakes? What are you going to do? I mean, I just don't understand what regulatory body. I don't understand what group, as someone who's worked in TV news for a long time in news, I don't know what mechanism could possibly exist right away, even though we're talking about a lot of cooperation all the way around, right? But how can something, some deep fake that just looks, you know, amazing, can be stopped? And who is doing anything about it? And I'm going to make you talk too, Alexandra. Okay, go ahead.
I'll say two things quickly then. So I don't think it can be stopped, right? I think that's not really achievable. So I think the question is, you're kind of going to what you said, like, how do you educate people enough to be aware of what's happening and how do you give them more information? And there is an initiative called the Content Authenticity Initiative, which also was started by one of the companies I represent, Adobe, but now has over 1,000 companies that are involved in it. And the idea is that people have a very easy way of telling when they look at something whether or not it has been manipulated. And then they can decide what they're going to do about it. So it doesn't stop it from existing, but it does the idea is to give people very easily accessible understanding about what has happened to that image.
Right. And the watermarking too, right? This is another thing. How big is that?
The watermarking in part goes to try, you know, you have AI that's being trained on large data sets and I've heard it mostly in the context of is what is being trained on protected by copyright? Is it creative content? And I think there could be a lot of really interesting issues around the creative community and how AI is being trained and then what AI generates and what the copyright rules are around that.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're seeing a lot of companies tackle the question of labeling generated content or making it distinguishable in some way. We already have a problem of disinformation. We already have this problem. The 2016 and 2020 elections we didn't have all these generative systems, but we still had this problem. So I think the existing effort that we started for digital literacy or just like information literacy, does what you're reading sound too good to be true or sound too crazy to be true? Or is it from some weird website you've never heard of before? These things remain the most important things to talk about. You know, we can try our best to create a tool that will mark things, and the people who were going to abide by the law anyways are going to use them, and the people who weren't, aren't. So I think it's all back to education.
If I could just introduce maybe two new topics, and Victoria, you started to talk about one, which is the copyright issue, which is something we are thinking a lot about at Google, and Alexander Beach from Google, I lead public policy at YouTube. I would just love others' thoughts about whether the existing legal regime is sufficient, both on the what is ingested by the systems, as you called out, but then also what the outputs are. So would love thoughts there. And then I think one concept we really haven't talked at all about here is national security. You know, keeping front of mind that we are in a global race on every front against China. And so how do we make sure AI remains a tool for the liberal democracies of the world and keeps the U.S. at the forefront?
Yeah, she asked it. You go.
The national security implications are significant. And I think if the administration has been focused on one aspect of AI for the last few years, that's been it. I do think I keep talking about this sort of group of countries, but I think one of the reasons that's important is to create a counterweight. China has already sort of been out there with what its approach is going to be in terms of artificial intelligence. And there are a number of aspects of that that make me uncomfortable.
Kelly, national security.
I'm not going to touch the copyright one because I don't know the answer. But on national security, I think one thing that I think sometimes we lose track of is that our intellectual economy, our innovation economy, is very deeply entangled with Chinese academics, and especially when you talk about AI. I think like some incredible number of papers are co-authored by Chinese and American researchers. And I know there's a lot of concern about that information being funneled back to China, but we have to also remember that if we discourage those academics from coming here, because generally what happens is you do your undergrad at Tsinghua, and you come here, and you go to Stanford, you go to MIT, you go to Carnegie Mellon, and then you stay for the most part. And yes, maybe you were funneling things back, but you're here. You're creating your work here. If we shut off all of these pipes and we close all these doors, you're going to be in China creating the same work. And our collaboration will be cut off. So these innovative things that are happening here are going to slow down. We're going to lose a lot of the talent that drives a lot of what we do. Some of the people who were going to become amazing Americans and love democracy are going to stay in China, and they're going to be part of this iron curtain of information. And then, you know, we can talk for days about the actual, like, literal military applications of this, but for me, this question of national security in China always comes down to this symbiosis between our two nations, the importance of the interchange, the fact that there are normally 14 to 15,000 American students studying abroad in China. Right now there's 350. They have closed their doors. They are turning people away that have valid visas. We should all be very concerned about this, because when China controls everything that people know about America, and there's no Americans going there to learn anything about it, and no Chinese coming here to learn, that's when things get really bad. There is no humanity between the two nations anymore. Like, I'm not even about AI anymore. But this is, I think AI is just like this collaboration ground, and we gain a lot from China. We gain a lot from open doors, from immigration policies that allow them to come here, and we shouldn't lose sight of that.
Okay, anyone else want to jump in on that? Go ahead. Liz Johnson. You have to stand, though. Sorry. We made everyone else stand.
Liz Johnson, I'm Senator Mitt Romney's chief of staff. Thank you for doing this. I was just curious if you could speak to what, obviously, legislation in our democracy is slow and it's hard, and it's, I think, at a minimum months away. Could you speak to what tech companies are doing currently or should be doing in the interim to sort of self police, if you will, or self-regulate?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to, but I'll try to keep it brief. So I think, so you said tech companies, and this actually gives a point that Paul made too. I think there are companies that are creating or training or developing AI, and then there are a lot of companies that are using AI. And I think to focus on either, I think we need to focus on both, right? So it's, I think there needs to be obligations that are for the developers or for the deployers to use kind of more technical word. And then, of course, there are a lot of companies that are going to be in both of those camps, depending upon what they're doing at that moment. I think when the AI is going to be used in a way that's going to be consequential or high risk, or, you know, these various terms that are out there, then I think companies, whether they are using it or deploying it, need to put a number of steps in place. Some of them as they're going through the development process, but then a lot also is being used to be like retesting, reevaluating, have internal evaluation processes that will move quickly if they're seeing outcomes that are inappropriate or inaccurate. And so I think those are things that companies can and should be doing now. I mean, we at BSA put out sort of a 50-page framework of very practical operational things that we think companies can and should be doing right now in order to be developing or deploying responsible AI. But a lot of that goes to like testing at every point of the system and then having a very quick internal process to stop or correct where you are seeing outcomes that are inappropriate, inaccurate, skewed in some manner.
The five-word answer, the NIST risk management framework. I think somebody, like today, a couple of senators put out a thing that said that they want to mandate that government vendors actually apply that risk framework. It's voluntary, but it's very thorough. They've done a lot of work to make sure that it's usable. There's case studies that help you apply it. You know, it's a very solid framework. And so I think companies...
100% echo.
Yeah, if you're concerned, if you don't want to develop your own thing, or if you want to keep building public trust, like use the established one that the government already put together. Don't reinvent the wheel. That would be my thing.
I'll just say, I think it's really interesting. When this came out, this goes back... We did something called the Federal Desktop Core Configuration to lock down the Microsoft operating system with them years ago, and it worked really well. They did the same thing. And then they did the NIST definition of cloud, which got used around the world. We would get RFPs, and NIST would be quoted, so people really look at it. So I do love your idea. Then if you could do compliance and security controls through GSA or, you know, however you're going to do the updates, you can start quickly on making recommendations on controls. I think that would be super impactful too, because people use them. Other enterprises use them a lot. You just, you know, especially if you'd like, you can bring those folks in and guide them toward those security controls.
And Secretary Raimondo, who's the head of the Department of Commerce, has been a real leader on AI inside the administration. And I think what NIST has done, which is part of the Department of Commerce, is very powerful.
Well, thank you, ladies. I think they did a great job. Continue to meet. If you have ideas, tell us. If you want to co-host with us, let us know. Thank you so much. Thank you, ladies. Much appreciated.
Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by HatEd Media.